month, we get caught up with our state's ag commissioner, Dr. Mike Strain. He joins us right now. Dr. Strain, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Thank you. I'm doing a little bit better. We're getting a little bit of rain. You know, we're getting a little bit of relief on the continual battle against these wildfires. You know, the big fight started on August 22nd in the early afternoon, and that was the Tiger Island fire. And so we spent the next 3 days and three nights, my team, fighting with all that we had to save the town of Maryville. Because this was a huge fire. That fire got up to about 34, 35,000 acres. And, you know, we've got the track now reduced to about 31,000. We're still there fighting fire. Now, this has been since the 22nd of August. And, you know, within 48 hours, we had reached out for additional assistance across the United States. We brought in what's called the Red Strike Team, and that is U.S. Forest Service, and it's made up of highly trained people. They come in with their equipment, their personnel, and they brought in 220 personnel. Put it in perspective, my entire Office of Forestry is 155 people. You know, I have over 150 firefighters. And so when you look at this, within a week, the fight on that fire grew to 1,200 firefighters.
Wow.
From 26 states. And so, and also working with the Louisiana National Guard, and they were bringing in helicopters. Some we had here, they would rotate them in from other states. We had 7 to 8 of the, you know, big Blackhawks doing what we call Bambi buckets, water drops.
Yep.
And then we brought in a Chinook, which could... That Chinook, one Chinook can do what 4 to 5 of the other helicopters can. So that's a big water drop. And then we brought in air tankers. And we brought in air tankers. They're private contractors. They were coming in out of Abilene, Texas. And so we brought in air tankers, and they call them super scoopers.
Okay.
And so these planes, you got to picture this. We had two of these that they would land in Toledo Bend and run for a mile, skim the top of the water. That's how they would load, come up, and drop water.
Right.
And they would cycle very fast. So they've been doing that a while, and we told one of them, so you do realize they got some stumps out there, right? Y'all are being careful.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
And then we brought in the air tankers that would drop the retardant.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see these are big, you know, jet aircraft, big aircraft. And then we brought in some VLATs, which are very large air tankers. And so when you get to the height of the battle, and at the same time we had one breakout, you know, within the same region of DeRidder, and that was the Highway 113 fire. And then we had the Ida fire that started, you know, from a neglected trash pile near the state forest, the national forest, the Castache. And so that was involving the Castache Forest and Fort Polk. That grew to over 10, 12,000 acres. The 113 fire to around 12,000 acres. You know, the Tiger Island, over 30,000 acres. So at one time, when you put that in the Elizabeth fire, the Ragley fire, and when they get big, they get names. But we had, you know, fire fronts on over 50,000 acres. You put that in perspective, you know, you're talking about 50, 60 square miles.
Okay.
So do the math and look at, you know, when you've got, you know, over 100 miles of fire lines. Now, you think about a fire line farther than from here to Lafayette.
Right.
A fire line, right?
Yeah.
And so these fires were so intense and so hot, you would see flames 300 feet in the air. Now, these are 100-foot pine trees.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, well, how does that happen? You know, and is that the normal thing that we see? No, it's not. What's happened here is, one, this is one of the most extensive droughts in Louisiana history that we have ever seen,
right,
certainly in my generation. And then you have a situation where we have this high-pressure system that's not allowing the moisture to come in from the Gulf. We haven't had, you know, normally we've got all these tropical storms and sometimes hurricanes, and nothing's happened. We haven't gotten very, very little rain. So that high holds that rain away. And then we have the aftermath of Laura Delta and Ida with more than 1 million acres of timber on the ground.
Right.
So you think these trees on the ground, and they lined up like Lincoln logs next to each other. And then you've got the broken off with the stumps. You got all this extra fuel. So you put all this together, and it's a perfect equation for wildfires. And so, and when it starts, you know, if you look Sunday, a week ago, you know, we're in there and we're in the height of battle, and we had 14 fires come in 10 minutes, in addition to the fires you're fighting, and that's with all personnel. So it's been, we've all been working together. The governor's done an exceptional job. We brought it working through GOSEP, Governor's Office of Homeland Security,
mm-hmm,
and Emergency Preparedness, through our sub-EOC, our Office of Forestry, working with you know, the U.S. Forest Service, hand in hand with the National Forest Service there at the Castachi, the National Guard, and all the firefighters. So you have our teams, our firefighters with the specialized equipment. We have the teams that have come in to help us. We have the National Guard, and we had over 400 guardsmen. Their big D-7 dozers, their equipment, as well as their aircraft working, you know, from the air and on the ground. And all the firefighters, your volunteer firefighters, your regular firefighters, the Office of the State Fire Marshal, his teams, our teams, and everyone working together. And we have, and so, and we continue to fight. We'll continue to fight until we have won. But, you know, we have not lost a town. You know, more than 10,000 structures have been at risk, more than 10,000 altogether in all the fires. And if you look in the normal month of August, I fight about 35 fires for about 8,000 acres. This August, I fought 551 fires for 50,000 acres.
It's insane.
And overall, we some houses were lost, about 10 homes were lost, but 10,000 were at risk. But to put it in perspective, in 1924, 5 million acres burned in Louisiana.
Really?
17% of the whole mass of Louisiana. And then in 1942, 1.2 million acres burned.
Okay.
And so if you look at what we've held this now to about 1% of what happened, you know, in 1924, and using every bit of modern technology, every bit of equipment. And but the thing of it is that, you know, when the other states ask us to help them, we go.
Right.
When we ask them to come help us, they came. And they're still here. So the Red Strike team that came in initially on Tiger Island, now the blue team is here, the red team. They stay about 2 weeks, and then they rotate out, and they are there working several major fires.
All right, can I ask, Ed Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain is our guest. I got to ask, where is Tiger Island?
Tiger Island is, if you know where the town of Maryville is.
I do, and so, it's right there. So, it's so as if you close have the, to Texas as you can get.
That's right, right. So between Tiger Island and Maryville, you know, if you go north by west, is Texas. So it's right on the Sabine. We had embers 20 miles in Texas burning from the Tiger Island. So it, right there, right by the little town of Maryville, if you Tiger Island would be due just north and slightly east across.
Okay.
So Tiger Island is not a location. It's a name because it started off, the fire started at the Tiger Island Hunting Club. So that's how they get a name.
There's not like an island.
It's not like an island.
But
it's a hunting club.
It's not a town's name either.
No, it's not.
Okay, because there is a Tiger Island down in South Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not it.
Yeah.
That's not it. So the way these fires are named is generally the first unit that gets there, they look for something familiar that people, the other teams may recognize, and that's how it's named.
Okay.
Highway 113, because it was on Highway 113.
That one makes sense.
Yeah, Ragley fires by the little community of Ragley, you know, Elizabeth Fire. They get names.
I feel bad for that poor woman, Elizabeth. Oh, she showed up and they saw her.
Yes.
Now she's got a fire named
after her. The Lions Camp Road Fire, you know, and so, but they all get names, and when it goes in, but then we all keep the same name, and then that's how it's recorded. And for the first time ever, there's a federal program that we're using in this. It is the Federal Wildfire and Emergency. There's a grant. You have to apply for the grant during the fire, not afterwards.
Okay.
During. And if you have to have endangerment that one that without all the additional assistance that you may not be able to contain the fire, and that two, that homes, residences, and towns are at risk. The good news is once it's approved, they will reimburse us for 75% of our cost. If you look at the Tiger Island fire, as we were fighting that fire, my normal yearly budget for firefighting is about $12 million.
Okay.
And I'm spending $1 million a day. I'm still spending probably $1 million a day. And so when you look at that, you can rapidly exceed your whole budget. But, you know, just at the cost of fuel. And if you look at these air tankers, if you look at the helicopters, those run about $4,000+ an hour each. Each deployment is 4 hours.
Goodness.
So if you have six of them in the air, six times four, that's $24,000 an hour times five. So you rapidly, you know, you can spend $125,000 a day on that. And if you look at the cost of these air tankers, you know, anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000 per drop is what it costs. But without them, you can't stop the fires.
Right.
And of course, if you know the cost to fly these great big jet, these are big jet aircraft. They're not small. They're big. The cost to fly those and operate them. And the bottom line is we've never had to do that before. We've never had fires of this intensity, and the fire is so big and so hot, and the wind is pushing them that the sap in the trees vaporizes.
Mm-hmm.
And you can smell, if you're there, you smell this faint turpentine, but all that volatilizes, and that's what runs, that's the flame that goes hundreds of feet in the air, but it can also go 300 feet out. And so that was the thing. It's not like you can just plow a fire line. And when the fire's running, and we call it in the canopy or in the tops, it's running over your head in the top of the trees, not on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
We got to knock that fire down, and so that we can stop it, you know, by plowing, you know, your traditional fire lines.
Ag Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain is our guest. So the fires are under control right now, but they're not out yet.
They're not contained. There's two different words. Controlled, we have burn lines around them,
mm-hmm.
and we are actively putting out anything that we find. Containment means when they're out, they're out. I mean, they're out.
Oh, no, yeah.
So several days ago, we had a fire that erupted, and it erupted on the northeast and southwest corner of a previous fire that we had put out
a month ago. Northeast and southwest?
That's right. And it was over a mile in between. And so what happened, you had a downdraft of air, a downdraft that blew out along those lines, because you look at these very strange weather patterns. You know, when these storms come in, you've seen these 30-knot winds blowing.
Yeah.
Well, so you have embers that are either at ground level or actually underground, right, where the stumps are burning out underground.
Yeah.
And then that blows, and then those embers can go for miles and reignite. And but that fire had been out a month.
A month?
A month. Jeez, a month. You know, so the traditional way, you know, to fight wildfires, you plow fire lines around them,
mm-hmm.
you control them, they burn themselves out, and you leapfrog to the next one.
Okay.
But if you look, you know, again, on that one Sunday, we're fighting all these fires, and then we have 14 fires come in 10 minutes, 14 new ones, 9 of which were lightning. And if it had a big fire in St. Tammany Parish, 200 acres, 3 lightning strikes right next to each other. It got so hot that deer were incinerated.
Incinerated. Whoa.
So they had nowhere, they couldn't run. They couldn't get out of there.
Right.
But the lightning hits the ground, and then it ignites. And what's happening with these weather patterns, we have these scattered thunderstorms, but there's lightning ahead of them, big lightning show. You've seen that.
Right.
And the lightning, rather than just being absorbed into the ground or setting a tree on fire, causes a wildfire. And then if you don't get the rain behind it, and we were very fortunate in St. Tammany, the rain came, and it was about a 200-acre burn. So far in this month, we're having back to our normal about 10, 12 fires a day.
Mm-hmm.
During the big fight, we were having 20 to 30 fires a day. But it's been, I tell you, I'm very proud of the men and women in the fire service, all of them at every aspect. Because, you know, we have our guys, some of those guys were on those dozers, you know, day and night. You pull them off, say, look, you got to get at least 4 or 5 hours sleep. 2 hours later, they show back up.
Right.
And get back on those dozers and just keep fighting.
So as a result of the drought, we're still under that burn ban.
Absolutely.
That burn ban
is
being violated everywhere, it seems.
Well, we are writing citations, and we have all together, it's probably been at least 50 citations written. A fire can get out of control extraordinarily rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And not only in the forest. You know, I was traveling through row crop country. I flew on Monday, and then I've been driving since. And you can see that those crops, if that fire hits those crops, it's going to burn them up.
Mm-hmm.
And once that fire starts, we could have another Tiger Island, another Elizabeth, another 113. So please, as soon as we can, we're going to lift the burn ban. Like we say, don't light that match, because as Smokey says, only you can prevent wildfire.
We got Ag Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain with us, and yes, the burn ban is still in effect. When we come back from break, we got news coming your way about 30 seconds from right now. When we come back from break, I do want to talk about what goes into that evaluation, because mm-hmm. getting together a week from now, I don't see a whole lot of rain in the forecast between now and then. We'll hit news, we'll hit traffic, I'll cover the weather, we'll hit that forecast, we'll talk about the burn ban next. But we're also going to have to pivot a little bit as well, because this drought is affecting the crops, and fall planting is upon us. We got a lot of ground to cover, and we do so. We hit it all.
We might have to bump Moon.
You want to bump Moon?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fun? Oh, man. Hey, Dr. Strain, we were talking about wildfires and the burn ban in our last segment, and we do have a lot more ground to cover as well. So, but I wanted to follow up with this. What goes into that evaluation of continuing the burn ban?
So, one, if you look at, this is the drought monitor that was published within the last hour.
Okay.
This is done every week. And so All the data is collected, turned into the National Drought Monitor System on a Tuesday. This is published every Thursday. And if you look at Louisiana, the majority of the state is in either extreme or severe drought. If you look at the colors.
I'm looking at
extreme
the colors.
And look at exceptional drought.
Okay,
here. So this is really bad. And so when you look at this, and then we also take a look at what's called the burn index and all the conditions. And so across the state, any of this, anywhere you see this in this whole state is under drought. Everything and the very top of the state is abnormally dry,
right.
But here's severe. So we take that into consideration. And also, you know, when you look at it, we know that if the fire breaks out with the current weather conditions, you could have a major fire.
Let me paint the picture for the radio audience since they can't see what we're looking at. It's basically the southwestern third of the state. I mean, if you're looking at Louisiana as
an
boot, you would
drought.
Go from the heel all the way to the middle of the foot, and then probably up to just south of Alexandria, as far north to be under exceptional drought, the worst class of drought. I was getting to that. And then move over, basically skip us and head over to a lot of Livingston, Tangipahoa Parish, and then all the way up north to the top of or to the Mississippi state line right there, also under extreme drought. Now, the areas surrounding the extreme drought are in the second worst condition. I'm sorry, the areas surrounding the exceptional drought are extreme drought, the second worst condition possible. And that is, if you're looking at Senlaw up north, you're going to get north of Natchitoches on the west side and continue east from there. It's not a straight line, but it's pretty close until you get up close over near Monroe. And then in southeast Louisiana, it is, all but, there's some of St. Tammany Parish in there. There's some of Jefferson Parish in there. Orleans is in the severe drought part, not the extreme drought part. But we're seeing more maroon and red, and I mean by like a, what, like a 7-3 ratio there? Mm-hmm. 70% of the state?
That's right.
Would be either extreme or exceptional drought. And then the farther north you go, the less extreme it gets, and the farther east you go, farther southeast you go, it gets a little bit less there as well.
And so the other consideration you have to look at, this is the beginning of our fire season, not the end. So all of this started before our regular big fire season normally occurs, September, October, November.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the big fires that we fought before, the big Creston fire, which was November the 14th, 2011, that was in November. And if you look at the Oil City fires within 2 weeks of that, again, in November of 2011, and so we've still got a ways to go. And what you have to look at here, you know, we have all of our equipment is deployed. You know, we have all this manpower, and we've brought in additional people. And when you get a major fire, when you start battling these fires, and you have all assets committed.
Yeah.
That's the big, all assets. And another one starts, and you've got to pull assets off that big, huge fire that's threatening an entire town or a city in order to try to get a handle on the others. And so our goal now this month is to get back into the normal battle rhythm where we hold those fires to under 10 acres.
So,
and that's extremely well to hold them to 8 to 10 acres.
I would imagine.
To hold that so they don't become a 30 and 40,000 acre fire.
So with the assets that are already in use, with the assets that are already been expended, with the amount of acreage that's already been burned or is burning right now, mm-hmm. is there any reason to believe the burn ban is going to continue all well into October?
Well, we address it every Wednesday. So I work with the state fire marshal. I work with our state forester, Wade DeBay. I work with Casey Tingle, who's the governor's office of Homeland Security. We also work directly with NOAA and the National Weather Service. So we look at all these factors and we make a decision. And if we can get enough rainfall, you know, in specific areas, if we think it's wet enough, then we will lift the burn ban when we can. Now we may lift it and have to reinstate it. But right now, it's too risky because what can happen is that, again, you can get a major break. Now, we're talking about, in addition to the forest, we're talking about the fields.
Right.
And if you look at those fields, if you look at a soybean field right now, they're drying them down. Still got about 30% of them left to harvest. And if a wildfire gets in there, it'll take the whole field out.
Okay, let me re-ask the question. Okay, from the fire standpoint, but from the ag standpoint.
Yes.
What is the harm in overextending the burn ban?
Well, what happens is that, you know, a lot of people, that there's a lot more that will be burned when we lift it. And so, you know, the longer you keep a burn ban, the bigger the trash piles get, you know, all those piles. And what happens is that if you leave it too long, then people may start ignoring it. So we want to be judicious with it, but we're not going to lift it as long as there is risk. Now, at some point on agricultural burning, we're going to have to allow the burning of the sugarcane.
Right. You know, that's November.
Late
October into November.
Well, they're going to start harvesting 1st of October.
Right.
Maybe. You know, they may delay that a little bit, and hopefully, you know, what they want to do is get a little moisture and get a little more growth out of that cane. But probably we may not allow the burning of standing cane. It may only be for the debris that's on the ground. It's more controlled. The burning of the standing cane is when it throws the embers in the air that we're worried about. And so that's a much hotter fire than the ones where you have the debris that's on the ground. And so, again, at some point, we're going to have to make that decision. But I probably have until, you know, 15th, 18th of October before we have to really take a hard look at that. And so when we can, we will lift it, but we're not going to lift it as long as there's great risk. Because the risk is several fold. One, that you get a major fire. Two, that we'll get major fires and not have the assets to fight a fire somewhere that day as quickly as we can and have greater loss. And when you talk about these fires threatening an entire community.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's how serious it is. And in the fight for Maryville, you know, the orders were, whatever we do, you know, we're not going to lose Maryville. Three days and three nights. And we would, and then we got the other teams in. And by day with the aircraft, we would push the fire back. But then at night, you had to hold the line until you could get air cover the next day. You know, and that was the normal battle rhythm for that. And because though that aircraft, I tell you, they make a huge drop. They drop that water on, it knocks the fire down out the tops, it chills it just a little bit, and I can get my dozers in there.
Right.
You know, and get them close enough. But I can tell you, if you look at our firefighting equipment, our bulldozers, we put 5 years wear on them in a month. And they literally look like you sprayed them with acid and put them out in the rain and let them rust. I mean,
Why is that, because of how close they are to the heat?
Absolutely. Wow. Yes. And the heat and the fire, yes.
We're talking with Ag Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain. I do want to pivot here because not necessarily because of the wildfires, but because of the drought. I want to ask you about crop conditions right now and what we can expect in the coming weeks.
Well, if you look overall at the crop conditions, there are some issues that we have seen. You know, overall with our crops, hay is the one that is hit the hardest. If you look at the overall hay conditions, 63% of all the hay is rated as poor.
Okay.
If you look at soybeans, about 38% of the soybeans are rated in poor condition. Vegetables, about 28%. So what you see when you look out there, we are going to have a significant loss due to drought. We're lucky with the corn that when the drought hit and the heat hit, most of the corn had already been drying for harvest. But with the soybeans, if it is not irrigated, then you have probably 10 to 20 bushels per acre, where we're normally at 50 to 60. And so then with the heat, if it's too hot at the wrong time, reproduction is a luxury in plants, animals, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have a lot of pod and very few beans. And hay that's the big deal, is that hay and pasture, you're having a lot of livestock are being sold because the farmers can't keep them. And that's here, and it's across other areas of the United States. And so far, there's still a shortage of beef out there for consumption. But next year, beef prices are going to be a lot higher.
Okay. Yes. All right. Just as a point of clarification.
Yes.
What is hay?
What is hay?
What is hay?
All right. Well, hay is properly cured grass. And so you grow this grass, and it can be many different types of grass. So you can have Bermuda, Bahia, Alicia, Bahia. You can have ryegrass. And then at the appropriate time, in the appropriate fashion, it's cut, it's dried, and it's baled.
Okay.
And that's what the cattle eat in the wintertime when they don't have forage on the ground. So you plant winter forage. You can plant, you know, wheat. You can also plant ryegrass and that sort of thing for the cattle in the wintertime. But you supplement them with hay. And what happens, properly cured hay is high in protein, very nutritious. And that's how you get them through the winter. You also generally supplement that with an energy source.
And that's I was close, but I always thought it was the byproduct of all the other products.
No, sir. That's a primary crop.
Okay.
No. Now you can take corn stover, you can take other things, grind them up, and as a byproduct. But no. Hay is a primary crop. Yes.
Okay.
It has to be. It has. look, you got to know what you're doing to bale hay. It's got to be done right. It's got to be dry. You know, it can't have, you know, too much moisture in it.
And therein lies the problem, right? Like, we need more dry stuff out there right now?
Well, here's the thing. You can bale your hay if you got any to bale.
Okay.
So hay is going to be very short this year. It's going to be very valuable this year. And it's a commodity. If you're a cattle farmer, you have to have it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about managing water. We got a minute till break.
Water's a huge issue, and we need to talk about that because don't waste any water. And it's a huge problem now in Lower Plaquemine Parish. Mm-hmm. I've been on the telephone with Mr. Hinckley, who is the parish president down there. That saltwater wedge is going to overtop the underwater levee in 2 weeks.
Wow.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, so that's a big deal.
And Plaquemines Parish is a big deal. And I've been talking to our farmers and also to the parish president. We're going to have further conversations with GOSEP on that matter.
We got a break here. Ag Commissioner Dr. Mike Strain is our guest. All right, Dr. Strain, we've got about 2.5 minutes left on the air. 3, really.
If we stretch it, we'll take Moon's time.
We'll continue on Facebook Live if we need to, for sure. I can't take Moon's time. He comes after me, and he's got reach on me. He's a little bit taller. So, in those last 2 minutes or so, I want to talk about something a little more positive. Can we dive into some certified Louisiana?
Absolutely. You know, and if you look at Quentin's Ice Cream, for instance, there in the Irish Channel, you know, he's got that old-fashioned recipe. He does a Creole cream cheese ice cream.
I love Creole cream cheese.
Oh, my gosh. And if you
it's such a simple flavor and perfect.
And he loves making this ice cream.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, he's got a premium-grade ice cream. You can get it at the finer restaurants in New Orleans. But he developed an ice cream sandwich. So it's a vanilla bean ice cream, but it's got a chocolate chip cookie crust that is unbelievable. It also does baked Alaska and sorbets. And if you look at the certified family, we have more than 500 companies now in certified Louisiana. Everything, you know, you talk about J.T. Malik. And, you know, you talk
about...
Love
J.T. Malik.
Oh, yes. And, if, you know, that's a family that came and started raising rice on 25 acres a century ago. And they're still right there.
Like,
right,
what are we
going
to do with all this rice?
It's right there. Well,
vodka and then make whiskey.
Yes, and they're also in the crawfish business, but they started value added. And that's what certified Louisiana is about. And so when they make vodka, they make rice, whiskey.
It's amazing, by the way.
About here in Louisiana, you know, we're making a lot of rums, a lot of whiskeys, and we're making out of rice. We're making it out of sugarcane, sugar mm-hmm. juice, and some really, really premium products. We have a lot of companies certified in Louisiana that make craft beers and wines, like Landry Vineyards and others, all sorts of spices, all sorts of food products. We have certified Louisiana restaurants. So you buy fresh, you buy local, you buy certified Louisiana. And let me tell you what's so important about that. You know, we talk about promoting seafood. You know, if you look at our crawfish products, if you look at all those things, you know, it's the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to taste the Louisiana certified Cajun, certified Creole, certified farm to table, that whole certified family.
There's a few that we're going to put on your radar here in just a second because we got to close out. I don't need Moon coming after me. But yeah, certified Louisiana products are, look, we swear by them here. I love me some JT Malik. I got to tell you about a tequila maker.
Yes.
Let's continue that conversation over on Facebook Live. If you're listening on the radio, hop on Talk 107.3's Facebook page. We're going to keep Dr. Strain around for a couple more minutes.